The following is an interview with Frank Carlucci, Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget. It was conducted by Susan Yowell on January 23, 1973, in room 252 of the old Executive Office Building. One of the things that we've been doing is talking with members of the White House staff and then have been branching out into other executive offices. On the lower levels, we've been trying to just get a background of what they did while they were here. And then people who have been in the public eye, so to speak, who, their jobs are more defined. What we've been doing is talking to them briefly about what they might want to go into more depth on at a later time,
mm-hmm.
for a true oral history project on the administration.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the areas that you feel would be most significant from a historical point of view, and those which would not be completely documented in the files. And then also, of course, what interested you most personally during the administration. And I don't know really where to begin, because you have worked on the OEO and the OMB and now going over to HEW. Maybe the best thing to do would be, say, today, just to stick with OMB. And if that's all right with you.
Sure.
And possibly mention what your major responsibilities were. And
mm-hmm.
anything which you could think about talking about later. The other thing I should mention, we're not trying to go deeply into policy where we would be in sensitive areas, which might be really better left until later. I don't know how that affects you, but...
No, well, there are some sensitive areas.
Right. And of course, the tape of this, we'll do a brief summary of it now, which I'll send you a copy of, and you can go over it. And there's no worry about what would be done with the tape now, because there's virtually no access to them at all. They're considered the president's property.
Mm-hmm.
And would not be used at all until after the library opens, and then at that time, they would go through the normal screening process.
Okay, well, I guess you just want me to chat a little bit about what I did. I was brought over here by George Shultz to be the associate director of OMB, which is a job that was created subsequent to the Ash Commission report and the reorganization plan which set up OMB. In theory, the job was to deal with the management aspects of the OMB mission. I think that after about 6 months in the job, I came to the conclusion that the job should be abolished. And when this George Shultz left to become Secretary of the Treasury, which was about 9 months after I'd been in the job. And Cap Weinberger was to become director. And he and I discussed this and found that we were of the same view that the job should be abolished. The reason being that it was a very artificial distinction, that the principal management tool in the federal government, as it is in most businesses, is the budget. And that if you have the policy direction of OMB divided between budget and management, it is much harder to coordinate these things at the working level. And indeed, in some instances, we had found ourselves working at cross purposes. Well, we were not successful in getting the job abolished, I might add. Others had different ideas. I now understand that as I'm leaving OMB to go to HEW, that a decision has now been made to abolish the job and have only one deputy. In essence, the job was a dual deputy job. And a dual deputy kind of arrangement is always difficult. So I am pleased to note that there will be a single deputy here, and that will be Fred Malik. In terms of, this doesn't mean that I didn't have a lot to do. I found plenty of things to occupy myself. I suppose the vast majority of my time was spent, not the vast majority, I suppose the largest chunk of my time was spent in two areas. One, working on the president's reorganization proposals. I did most of the, I did all the testifying for OMB on those proposals and handled the coordination with the agencies and the policy formulation. We had regular planning sessions, and I think came fairly close to having the Department of Community Development Bill passed, at least by the House. The reason it was not passed, essentially, was that some of the... We got it voted out of committee. First of all, we got it voted out of Hollifield's committee by a highly favorable vote. My memory serves me correctly, it was something like 24-7. When that happened, all the lobbyists who had not really been taking DCD seriously became alarmed. The highway lobby started to work. But I think in the farm lobby, the REA, the Farmers Home Administration groups, started working on their congressmen. I think we could have handled that had not the OEO lobby gotten to the League of Women Voters. And I went over and met with the League of Women Voters, and they were all upset about what might happen to OEO. And we tried to reassure them, as we had reassured the committee, what kinds of structures we'd be dealing with. We were dealing essentially with organizational matters, not program matters. But when the OEO groups, when the League of Women Voters sent a letter to every congressman, I think that created problems for us. And the thing began to unravel. And the bill was actually bottled up in the Rules Committee. Now the administration, of course, will be going back in similar legislation again this year. And I think prospects have improved. The second area where I spent a lot of my time was in the area of coordinating agency activities in the field through the Federal Regional Council mechanism. I came to the conclusion fairly early on that the idea of a Federal Regional Council, that is, the major domestic grant-making agencies working in concert and having a formal structure for doing this, was a good idea. A council mechanism had been set up which simply required the agencies to meet once a week and discuss common problems. Discuss common problems, and they would elect a chairman. The chairman was a rotating chairman. I felt we could push the system much further, that it was in danger of becoming just a, kind of a social club, and that it ought to be given a very specific mission, and that the chairman ought to be selected by the president, and there ought to be some reward for being chairman. So we developed an executive order, which would have the chairman designated by the president upon advice of the undersecretaries group, which was a policy formulation group in Washington for the regional council mechanism, and would make the chairman GS-18 for the period of his chairmanship, and we spelled out a specific mission of the Federal Regional Council. That executive order initially met with a great deal of opposition from certain agencies who perceived it as a threat to their lines of command, to the regions. But after considerable work with the Undersecretary, we managed to overcome that. And the executive order went out, and I think it's fair to say that the consensus is a considerable progress that we made under that executive order. A year later, we've taken a look at it. We've looked at the work plans and the progress against those work plans, and we're reasonably pleased with what has transpired. Other aspects of the job dealt with the Federal Labor Relations Program, sitting on the Federal Labor Relations Board, worrying about management information systems, performance measurement systems, coordinating legislation, dealing with whatever kind of crisis might come up, such as working on the planning of Phase 2 Economic Stabilization Program. The organizational structure for Phase 2 was actually developed in my office with a group of people that I've worked with in OMB under George Shultz's general guidance and that kind of thing.
I remember reading an article in the National Journal where you talked about the management of Office of Management and Budget. Was that prior to your discussions with abolishing the job? Was this, I can't remember the date of it. Was that before?
Well,
you
mind you,
came
I
came to the conclusion that
this is not to say that there wasn't.
Separated.
Yeah, my conclusion was not based on the fact that there was nothing to do in the job, because there was.
Mm-hmm.
My conclusion was based on the observation that a dual deputy system created very severe institutional problems down through the organization, and that we were spending a lot of energy overcoming these problems, which could be put to more productive purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So if I talked, and I think the National Journal article, yes, was before I came to that conclusion. But in that interview, I talked in general terms about the management problems of the federal government and the kinds of things we were trying to do in OMB. And I support all those things.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were doing the right things. It was just the question of how we organized ourselves internally to do them that began to be troublesome to me after a period. I think the right decision has now been made to combine these functions. For example, neither the deputy director nor the associate director had clear responsibility for the internal management of OMB. The deputy director was never involved. The associate director got involved in some aspects. The director got involved in other aspects. But nobody knew who to turn to for decisions on upward mobility programs or personnel, various personnel activities. This was always something that was a little bit confusing to people. And the division chiefs never quite knew who to go to on a subject that might fall between the management and budget cracks. So it was just a cumbersome kind. So that takes care of that job. And then when I got into the deputy director's job, the first thing that happened to me was that I was sent to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania to coordinate disaster relief. And when I got back from that, I found myself thoroughly immersed in putting together what has got to be one of the most difficult budgets that OMB has ever put together. And that budget will emerge on Monday. That's the Wilkes-Barre operation is a whole separate tale in itself.
Would that be something which would not be fully documented in the paper records, which should be supplemented, I should say, very often the paper records are
There are very few paper records on Oaksbury operation other than newspapers. I have a pretty extensive file of newspaper clippings that I'd be willing to make available to you.
Was the Wilkes-Barre thing something that was planned on a long range thing, or was this?
Very much spur of the moment. In fact, when it was decided to go up there, I was still in my tennis clothes and didn't have a chance to go back home. I had been on a couple of days vacation and I came back and it was a Friday night. I had been previously involved, let me first say, take a step back. When the Agnes flood occurred, I was in charge of putting together the legislative proposals that were needed to get the disaster relief program underway. The Agnes flood was far and away the largest disaster in our country's history. In terms of federal resources that went in, we put in more than twice as much money as went into the Alaska earthquake, the California earthquake, and the Rapid City disaster, and the West Virginia mine disaster combined. And Camille, all of those combined, we put in more than twice as much money. Just absolutely unprecedented in scope, probably over $2 billion worth of damage. President, I got a call on a Saturday night, I guess it was from John Whittaker, telling me the President wanted us to put together options for extraordinary legislation to deal with this, and he wanted to deal with it in generous terms. So we worked all weekend and on through the week at nights putting together the special legislation that was sent up for Agnes, and I went up and testified on it. Then I went off on a week's vacation. When I came back, I was informed that Secretary Romney had been up to Wilkes-Barre and had come back with a recommendation that a federal coordinator be sent up there, designated by the President, be sent up there, and that OMB was making an analysis of Romney's report for the President. And I allowed as how I ought to come in and take a look at that. And we worked on it on Friday night, presented some options, one of which was that I or somebody else, I think the other name we suggested was Bill Scranton, be designated the President's representative for the disaster area. I indicated in the paper that that was not the OMB favored option. We favored another option. But the next morning I got a call. Saturday morning, I'd just come off the tennis court and going through some papers. Got a call, I guess it was from Cap Weinberg, who said that they were having some discussion on Agnes and maybe I ought to come over. And at that point, I think we called John Ehrlichman, who was in Camp David, and he had indicated that the President had decided to send up a federal coordinator, or send up his personal representative to pull the agencies together, and that I was his choice. And I said, well, John, I really have other things to do. And if that's what the President really wants me to do, I'll do it. I said, well, it was what the President wanted me to do. And I said, okay, when do you want me up there? And he said, today. And I said, well, it seems to me before I go up there, if I'm the person, the President's personal representative, I ought to have a chat with him. He's and checked with the President, I guess, or somebody who seemed to be in the same room with him, and came back on the phone and said, be up here at 2:00 in the afternoon. And that was a separate tale on Agnes.
And you continued to be a coordinator in the disaster relief efforts.
I went up there, it must have been mid-August or late August. I flew directly from here without going home by helicopter to Camp David, met with the President, and the helicopter took me on up to Wilkes-Barre. And I was up there pretty continuously for about 2 months. And then I began to come back here and start worrying about the budget and commute to Wilkes-Barre. I'm doing both jobs. When I was named Undersecretary of HEW, nominated to be Undersecretary of HEW, I went up to Wilkes-Barre and announced that I was terminating my Wilkes-Barre operation. That was sometime in late December, December 21st.
Mm-hmm.
So, in theory at least, I was in charge of the operation for that period from mid-August through December. When I began to phase out, I had Bill Connor up there as my surrogate, and he did a very good job. But I'd spend a couple hours a day on the telephone making decisions. That was an extremely large and extremely difficult operation. We spent probably over $1 billion in 5 or 6 month period. In one county. So
that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Were there other areas which you got into, like the Wilkes-Barre thing, which were an offshoot of your normal budget functions, which would be significant to?
I assume you're going to talk to Lynn Garman about the BIA episode. I was drawn into that. Lynn and I were the two principal negotiators with the Indians on BIA, and I'm the one that went up and testified. I'm the one that was responsible for giving the Indians the $60,000 that people make such a fuss about and get out of town, and testified on that. So that's a whole other episode. I was involved in extracurricular activity.
Did you negotiate directly with the Indians too?
Yep. Len and I negotiated, I think it was a total of about 17 hours with the Indians to get them out of that building peacefully. And there's no question in my mind that what we've had a number of dead Indians today had we not done what we did. But I have a testimony on that, which pretty well documents it. There are papers on that to document what we did. My secretary and Brad Patterson can make available to you. There are not too many papers on the Wilkes-Barre operation. Well, there are a whole series of press releases on the Wilkes-Barre operation, which probably should be made available through the library. The man that can get them for you is Lou Helm. Yeah, in the Department of Interior. He was my public affairs manager. And I think you should probably call him before they're all destroyed.
Oh, you think they would be?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we should then.
Yeah. Because it was the largest disaster relief operation in our country's history.
Mm-hmm.
I think those were the major extracurricular activity violence over here.
You're saying, you're talking about papers being destroyed, does bring up one thing. Where would your activities during the administration be documented? Other than the ONB central files?
Well, the ONB central files, I suppose my personal file, and OEO, with the exception of the controversy over the California Rural Legal Assistance Program.
What about?
That was the famous CRLA feud between me and Ronald Reagan. It received extensive press conference and was responsible for my confirmation being held up for some 3 months.
Where would that be documented, or is it?
Well, I have personal files.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that dealt with CRLA was written in my office and locked in my safe. But there are some congressional hearings on it. There were 5 hours of a very stormy hearing in the House. But that is a subject that probably should be in the President's Library. It was a major controversy.
When you speak of your personal files, are these things which you plan to take on with you?
I will take that file with me to HEW, yes.
I hope that you will consider at some point having these deposited in the Nixon library.
Category of sensitive. I don't know, I can give you something to read.
This is something, I don't know if you're aware of the letters that Mr. Holloman sent.
Yeah, I have.
I think Joan Quinn had contacted your secretary about this.
Here's an article from the viewpoint of the subject.
Viewpoint of CRLA, it is not necessarily accurate, but in fact, in many cases, it's inaccurate and unfair, but it will give you an idea of what the episode was about. Mm-hmm. That was surely the most difficult problem I was involved in when I was in OER. Mm-hmm. I think we received something like 20,000 letters.
I hate to say I'm not familiar with.